by a revolution that occurred at the beginning of the 20th century, right at the turn of the century. And that revolution was initiated by a young man named Albert Einstein. I'll talk a little bit more about Einstein today, and I'll show you a demonstration of one of the mysterious phenomena that he managed to explain in 1905, a year in which he published four papers that would forever change the face of physics, and actually had a significant impact on geopolitics, health, the economies of many nations, and other things. Things we probably still don't even really completely understand. So let me get started. At the dawn of the 20th century, physics believed that it was at the verge of understanding everything about the cosmos. Newton had unified the heavens and the earth. Through the force of gravity and through his equations of motion, he understood that the falling of an apple was no different than the whirling of stars around galaxies or the whirling of planets around the sun. And all of that could be elegantly explained simply by the force of gravity and the laws of mechanics. And the laws of mechanics that sprung out of his description of nature by mathematics, his invention of the calculus to explain nature, they described a universe that was a machine, a perfect machine, a clockwork universe, whose outcomes could be perfectly described in every detail if you knew the initial state of everything. So it was largely believed that any outcome could be known exactly using the laws of mechanics. That's a very powerful place to be. Given initial conditions, you could explain the complete future history of any system. In addition, the laws of thermodynamics were worked out in the 1800s. These are the laws that govern the nature and movement of heat. Heat is just another form of energy, something that was realized in the 1800s. And in the 1900s, it was understood as the motion of atoms inside of material, the vibrations of atoms. So when you touch a hot stove and you feel pain, what you're really feeling is you're feeling the energy of billions of vibrating atoms bouncing into the atoms in your finger and doing damage to your cells. That's all heat is. And thermodynamics are the laws, there are three or four of them, that very neatly, very simply describe all of the properties of heat, conservation of energy as it applies to heat, and how heat can do work, which is the basis of how engines function. Okay, so your engine in your car is based on laws that were discovered in the 1800s, and through engineering, those laws have been applied to perfection in modern engines to make them as efficient as possible at changing chemical energy into mechanical work. And finally, we have the topic of this course, electromagnetism. The single theory expressed in Maxwell's equations, four little equations that tell you about electric charge, electric field, and magnetic field, and how they all relate to one another. Those four equations neatly summarized all then known electric and magnetic phenomena, made new predictions about the existence of electromagnetic waves that propagate through empty space, and as a result, predicted that light was an electromagnetic wave, because electromagnetic waves moved at the speed of what was then identified as the speed of light. And that was covered in one lecture that I gave you about 3 weeks ago. And it explained light as a wave, an oscillation of electric and magnetic fields. And there were genuinely people that believed at the end of the 1800s that apart from a few annoying little problems, physics was about to explain everything. And after that, it would all just be apply, apply, apply. There would be nothing more to be learned about the universe. It had been a stone that had been bled dry. Well, what were some of these annoying little problems? One of them, well, a few of them, centered around Maxwell's equations themselves. Every wave that had ever been identified needed a medium in which to propagate. Sound waves need air, water waves need water, and so forth. Mechanical waves, vibrations in metal, they need a crystal lattice, an atomic structure that can move and transfer the energy of the wave through the system. But Maxwell's equations claimed that no medium was needed for light to propagate. It seemed to describe waves of electric and magnetic fields in empty space propagating at 3 × 10⁸ meters per second. And that was a problem. Because if it really was a wave, it needed a medium. And so physicists tried to shove it in there. They called that medium the luminiferous ether. It had weird properties in that it only interacted with light and nothing else. It was an absolute reference frame, the perfect cosmic reference frame against which everything could be measured, and nobody could find it. Experiments were done to use the speed of light in different directions relative to the motion of the Earth to try to find the evidence that this ether existed. The motion of the Earth should affect the speed of light, and it didn't, and nobody could explain why. It seemed that to all observers, moving or stationary with respect to the Earth, light moved at the same speed. And that is really weird, because all experience said that there had to be a medium for a wave to propagate. All experience said that if I'm moving at 5 miles an hour and I throw a ball at 5 miles an hour in front of me, you see the ball moving at 10 miles an hour. Why doesn't light do that? What's so special about light? So this was a puzzle. But people believed that it would just be explained away and that would be the end of that. Here's another annoying little problem. And it has to do with this business of motion I was just talking about. Maxwell's equations had another problem. If you use the rules that people had at the time to relate observations in your frame of reference, you guys are all sitting there, okay, and I'm walking along and I throw this thing up in the air and catch it, you see the remote move in an arc. I see it move straight up and down. There's a mathematical transformation that we can use to relate our observations to one another. It's called the Galilean transformation. And it basically says that if I use my coordinate system and you use your coordinate system, and we relate the two using my speed of motion, we'll get consistent observations in our two different reference frames. And it worked really well for mechanics, but it failed for Maxwell's equations. So people assumed that Maxwell's equations were just wrong. They were the new laws on the block. Thermodynamics was largely settled business. Mechanics was definitely settled business. And the Galilean transformation worked fine in all of those, but it failed utterly in Maxwell's equations. So people just assume Maxwell's equations must be wrong. So the problem of the ether and the problem of motion were these, you know, two of these niggling little problems. Now, why would you throw out classical physics? It had been good for, you know, 200 years of hard work. So people were pretty much ready to toss Maxwell out the window. Here's another little problem. Actually, it has to do with thermodynamics. People were studying something called the black body in the 1800s. This is simply a body that absorbs radiation of all wavelengths and then re-emits it as heat. So think of coal or black pavement. Visible light strikes black pavement, and then you put your hand above the pavement, you feel heat coming off. It's black, there's no visible light coming off of it, but you can feel radiation coming off the pavement, especially on a nice hot Dallas summer. That's why they don't use blacktop around here. They use concrete for everything, because it's not as hot, okay? Black bodies were an interesting phenomenon in the 1800s. They were just being studied using the newly developed laws of thermodynamics. But there was a problem. You could very easily measure the spectrum of radiation coming off of a black body. And you could use the then newly discovered laws of thermodynamics to predict what that radiation spectrum should look like. And they had nothing to do with one another. The prediction said that as the wavelength of the light got shorter, as you go from reds to blues to ultraviolet, the probability of that kind of radiation being emitted went up. But measurements said it went up and then came back down. That's a bold disagreement between these two things, an experiment, the real world, a measurement of nature, and these predictions based on other observations that had been encoded in mathematical laws. This was called the ultraviolet catastrophe. They give it dramatic names in physics to make it sound really bad, right? But what it basically boils down to is the math predicted something that nobody observed to be true. And when that happens, you have a puzzle, you have a paradox. And that's usually nature screaming, you don't understand what you're talking about. Okay? So let's focus on the ultraviolet catastrophe for a second. This is something that if you were to go into a modern physics course, usually the course starts with a discussion of this. I'll summarize it. This is a young man named Max Planck who was born in the mid-1800s, sort of in the midst of the revolution in electricity and magnetism. He was German-born. He was a physicist by training. Brilliant mathematician, and he made very central contributions to the study of heat, that is, thermodynamics. And in 1894, he turned his attention to the then interesting phenomenon of the black body problem. Now, he wasn't so much interested in the ultraviolet catastrophe. He just wanted to be able to explain the radiation, the heat coming off of a black body, you know, at any given temperature that the black body is set to. He just wanted to be able to understand that. He wanted to simply gain insight into this phenomenon. And by 1901, he very reluctantly published an explanation that actually beautifully predicted the black body spectrum that was measured in the laboratory. But to do this, he had to abandon his principles. He did two things. First of all, he hated statistics. He didn't trust it. People were using statistics then to explain thermodynamics. You know, not all the vibrating things in a piece of matter are moving in the same way. Some of them are moving more quickly. Some of them are moving more slowly. Statistics lets you determine the probability that a given energy is assigned to a given set of, say, atoms in a material. You need statistics to do that because there's so many of them. You can't count them. So he reluctantly used statistics to understand the black body phenomenon, and he did something else that was pretty much offensive at the time. He hypothesized, and he said later that he did this simply as a mathematical convenience. He didn't believe it. He just did it because it worked. Maybe it would be explained later that his trick was wrong, but his trick worked. And his trick was the following, that the light in a black body, the radiation that's, say, trapped in an oven, okay, an oven is a very good example of a black body. You heat it up, you turn off the source of heat, and it will continue to hold heat of many wavelengths inside of it. It's not visible. It's, you know, stick your hand in there and it's warm, but you don't see the radiation in the oven. An oven is a pretty good black body, actually. But the radiation inside that cavity, inside of your oven, can't have any energy that it wants. It only comes in multiples of some fundamental frequency. And that was a crazy idea. That was the kind of idea that would end a career at the time. But he published it anyway, because it worked. And he even, in a letter to a friend of his, he said that a theoretical interpretation of the black body spectrum had to be found at any cost, no matter how high. Okay, this is how seriously physicists take this thing. Right? Because in physics, if you do something that's against what everybody else thinks to be the truth, you risk your career. You know, you don't get letters of recommendation for your next faculty position. Okay, but if you're right, it's a big payoff. So big risk, big payoff. So Planck largely dismissed his own work. He didn't understand the implications of what he had done, and he didn't want to believe it anyway. And so he's credited with explaining the black body, but modern historians of science would say that he really shouldn't get as much credit as he does for initiating the revolution called quantum mechanics. That is, the understanding that nature doesn't come in continuous, infinitely divisible pieces, but rather comes in discrete little pieces, whether it's energy or matter. Okay, that's simply what the quantum theory is, that there's a smallest thing, and that everything is multiples of that thing. That was a crazy idea back then. This is the implication of Planck's work. In order to explain the black body radiation, he had to assume that energy, in the form of the radiation in the black body, could only come in multiples of some frequency. So what he actually did was he said E is equal to NHF. Okay, F is the frequency of the light, the frequency of the radiation in the cavity. N is an integer. And H is some constant. He didn't know what it was, but he wrote it down so that he could get the units to work out. It's okay to do that, I guess, when you're doing frontier physics. Okay? All right, so then this is energy over here. And, you know, units matter. And actually, in this case, they matter so much a new constant was discovered as a result. So he had this beautiful, simple relationship, and he had statistics, which made it look really messy. But in the end, it's actually quite straightforward. And this was the result, that the energy of radiation, the energy of light, could be related to the frequency or the wavelength of that light. Okay, here it's written in terms of frequency. Simply by relating the two with a constant. That constant is known now as Planck's constant. And it is an extremely tiny number. H, Planck's constant, has a value of 6.626 times 10 to the minus 34 joules times seconds. Okay? You could use the conversion between joules and electron volts and put it into something that's maybe a more useful unit for things that are of atomic scale, but it's still really tiny. Okay, 1 joule is
1.6 times 10 to the minus 19, or 1.6 times 10 to the 19 electron volts. So it's still not a big improvement in the gap. Okay, so electromagnetic energy, is related to the frequency of the wave by a new constant, H. This was Planck's big contribution. And experiments were then done using black body spectrum, and it was measured. And that takes us to 1905. So Planck published his work in the early 1900s. And around that time, there was a young man named Albert Einstein. He was born in 1879. And at a very early age, he was fascinated by electricity and magnetism. His father ran a company that was tasked with developing direct current applications of electricity and magnetism. So basically motors, transmission lines for the new idea of using electricity to power things. His father recounted a story wherein his father once showed him a compass, and he was fascinated by the fact that the needle appeared to move under the influence of some mysterious force, magnetism, and he wanted to understand that force at a very deep level. He showed very early talent for both engineering and mathematics. He liked to build things, and he liked to calculate. And he was very good at both of those. Okay, so there's a mythology about Albert Einstein that he was terrible at math. Actually, that's not true. He was very good at math, in fact. When he applied to the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology in Zurich, his original application was turned down. But he excelled in his entrance exam on mathematics and physics. But he did badly on other things, and so his application was denied. But he did manage to get in eventually. In 1896, he was admitted to a teaching diploma program. And as I said, he had shown already outstanding performance on mathematics and physics. It was at ETH, the Federal Institute of Technology in Zurich, Switzerland, that he met his first wife, Mileva. And she was interesting in her own right. She was the only woman in a class of six that entered that year into the teaching program. And you can imagine what it was like for a woman in the late 1800s entering a math and physics teaching program at a respected institution like Zurich. Okay, let's say men were skeptical. Einstein and Mileva worked together, they studied together, and actually they pursued studies outside of what was being taught in the teaching diploma program. Some of that work later became an influence on Einstein's papers. They were married in 1903. They actually had a daughter in 1902 before they were married, but very little is actually known about that daughter, only reference to her in letters, and nobody knows what happened to her. They had a son shortly after they were married. Mileva, unfortunately, failed the exam for her teaching diploma. Einstein passed it. But then two frustrating years followed where Einstein couldn't get a job. He pissed off a lot of his faculty members at ETH, and it made it very hard for him to get into the teaching circles in Germany and in Switzerland. So his friends helped him out, and he got a job at the Swiss Patent Office. And that happened in 1900. He worked on patent review for electromagnetic devices. Surprise. He had talent for these things, and this is exactly where the patent office put him. Now, Einstein continued to work while he was employed at the patent office toward a PhD, so he was holding down a full-time job, and he was working toward his PhD degree. He's very bright and very hardworking, and it took a huge toll on his family. He was not very nice to Mileva. He cheated on her, in fact. He started an affair with his cousin in 1909, and eventually this led to the breakup, the informal breakup of his marriage with Mileva in 1912, and they were formally divorced in 1919, at which point he married his cousin. Okay, so people are complicated, and despite what you may or may not have heard about Albert Einstein before, like every human being on the planet, he has his messed up aspects, but he's also quite brilliant. Okay, so that same year, he got his PhD in 1905, he published four, now which are very clearly recognized as groundbreaking papers, although at the time, not everybody knew what to do with them right away. This usually happens. You publish these amazing papers, and then years go by before anybody takes you seriously. Okay? Because it takes time for the implications of these things to soak into the consciousness. These papers concern four topics. One was the atomic theory of matter. Then, still a controversial idea, that there were these things called atoms and that they made up matter. There was an observation, if you looked through a microscope at dust particles in a fluid, you'd see the dust particles jittering very quickly, almost random motion. And he was able to easily explain this using the atomic theory of matter and statistics. So that was the first compelling explanation of the Brownian motion. Okay, it's the same motion that will cause your creamer in your coffee to mix on its own without putting a spoon in. It's the heat. All the hot vibrating atoms will move the little bits of cream or fat around in the coffee for you. So, what's that? Brownian motion. Yeah. He also thought and then published work on how motion affects measurement. And this goes back to the thing I was talking about before, the Galilean transformation. How you and I would relate observations in our different frames of reference, me moving and you sitting still. The Galilean transformation was a long-cherished notion of classical physics, and he threw it out. Rather than throwing out Maxwell's equations, which failed under the Galilean transformation, he said, what if we've got the transformation wrong? What if our understanding of space and time are wrong? And he motivated this using the measurement of the speed of light as constant to all observers. He thought that was a really important fact that happened. So he ignored the existence of the ether. He said, you don't need it. The speed of light is the same for everybody, moving or not, because when you move, space contracts and time slows down. And the combination of those two things makes the speed of light seem to be the same for you. The speed of light becomes a meter stick by which you can measure the entire cosmos. It's the one constant thing that all observers will agree on. I'll talk a little bit more about that later. The paper I'm going to present a demonstration on today is his understanding of the nature of light. Maxwell's equations describes it as an electromagnetic wave. Einstein threw out that interpretation, at least briefly. Okay? The equivalence of matter and energy. This followed from his work on how motion affects measurement, and I'll talk a little bit more about that later. But mass was believed to be something independent of energy, kinetic energy, heat, and all that other stuff. Einstein, through his work on motion, recognized that they're the same thing. Okay? And that has stark geopolitical implications, which I'll talk about. So, let me talk about the photoelectric effect. This is the thing on which the entire revolution of quantum mechanics is essentially built. And it has to do with the following. What is the photoelectric effect? It's very simple. You have a conductor, like this aluminum can I have up here. You shine light on it, and you measure an electric current. So light striking a conductor can make charge move. Well, that's not a huge surprise. I mean, after all, light is an electromagnetic wave. It has an oscillating electric field. It has an oscillating magnetic field. When those fields strike an electron or some other conductor in a material like this, it's going to move. Electric fields accelerate charges, and magnetic fields then cause them to bend. Okay, so there's going to be motion, and that motion can be quite complex. So that, in and of itself, wasn't a big surprise. So why does this matter so much? Let's try to explain the photoelectric effect using the wave theory of light. So let's think about a second, all right? We now know that there are these things called electrons, and they orbit nuclei, and that together makes up atoms, and that those are stuck together to make metals, like the can over here. Now, just like a water wave striking something floating on the surface of a pond, an electron struck by an electromagnetic wave will move in response to it. Okay, it will be accelerated, for instance, by the electric field as it passes. If that electric field is strong enough, it could be enough to remove the electron from its parent atom, and now it's free to move. It's free to be conducted, for instance, under the influence of an external potential. Okay? So, that in and of itself is not so surprising. Let's use an analogy to understand this. Let's think about a ball stuck in some lily pads on a pond. So, let's think it's a nice summer day. You're out with your friends near a pond. You're playing some volleyball or something like that, and oops, you know, somebody screws up and puts the ball halfway across the pond in some thicket of lily pads. Okay, great. So, no one has a boat and no one wants to swim out into this leech-infested pond to go get the ball. That sounds sane. Now, you have lots of buckets, and they're all filled with ice for your drinks. Okay, you get an idea, okay, because you took physics, and you know about waves. So what you're going to do is you're going to do a little action at a distance to get that ball free and try to get it over to one of the shores of the pond. So you dump out one of the ice buckets, and you walk over to the surface of the pond, and you shove the bucket repeatedly into the pond. And this generates water waves. Okay, now you have upper body strength, but it's not enough. You're making waves, you can see the ball moving, but it's caught in these lily pads, and your waves are just not strong enough. So you're like, okay, I have an idea. Get some friends together, everybody get ice buckets. Everybody stand on the edge of the pond. Everybody push. All right, and let's say everybody had basically the same upper body strength as you. So they make the same kind of strength waves that you do. Now, something we didn't talk about, but something that you should have heard about in introductory mechanics, is that when you have two waves that overlap, if their crests are in the same location, they add up, and you get a wave that's twice as high. And that gives you twice as much energy in the wave. Okay? So you're hitting the surface of the water, your friends are doing it, you're not all doing it in sync. You know, it's been a hot day, you're all tired. But eventually, the waves add up enough, after a long enough period of time, that the ball jumps out of the lily pads and then it floats over to the other side of the lake. Okay? So that's what people thought was going on in metals with the photoelectric effect. You send in electromagnetic waves from a source, you strike electrons, and when the waves add up enough, regardless of how feeble your light is, you get movement of charge. You get a current. Let me do a demonstration of this, okay? So I have here a little setup that you can make on your own, if you like, for the photoelectric effect. It's a bit like magic, it seems, so you can do this for your friends over the holidays. If you have, in particular, a friend who's sanitation obsessed, you can do this part for free, okay? So here are the parts you need. So you need a Coke can, that's about $2, depending on whether you get it from a vending machine or not, right? Let's see, you need some sandpaper, okay? You need a styrofoam cup, I got a bunch of those, I got artistic, so I made a little stack. Okay, no problem, right? You need some tinsel, you need some little sheets of metal, okay? Got those. Let's see, what else do we need? We need a paper clip, got a bunch of those. Okay, you see I've attached the paper clip to the Coke can, and I hot glued the tinsel on the end. So I didn't put hot glue up here, but you can just borrow that from a friend or a parent or whatever. And let's see, then you need a paper bag, so I got one of those. And we'll just tear that up. No problem. Okay, let's see, PVC pipe. Yeah, got some of that. You can get that for a couple of bucks at Lowe's, that's no big deal. And then you can just, you know, give it to your plumbing-obsessed friend after that. Now this is the pricey thing, alright? UV sanitizing wand. This thing emits UVC, you know, the kind of stuff you want to wear sunblock to protect yourself from. Okay? $50. I overpaid for this. You can get them for $30. They're good for sanitizing your toothbrush, apparently. These are tuned to emit 252 nanometer wavelengths of ultraviolet radiation. You can't see it, but it's particularly good at busting up chemical bonds in cells. So any microbes that are exposed to it pretty much die. And that's why it's so useful. There's this beautiful little resonance when it comes to microbes that you can use ultraviolet to kill them. Okay? And in theory, they won't build up a resistance, but who knows what we're creating when we do this. Okay? All right. So you can do that for less than $100, but I got to say, demonstrating the photoelectric effect using household items for less than $100, priceless. Right. So here, we're going to do this now. Yeah, thank you. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to rub the PVC pipe with the paper bag. This adds some electrons to the PVC pipe, and I'm going to transfer them to the tinsel. And you see what happens with the tinsel, right? Electrons on a conductor, they all want to get away from one another. It was originally neutral, now it's carrying a net negative electric charge. So they all race as far as they can get away from one another. And this results in the mutual repulsion of the tinsel. Okay? So, do this. So you can see there you go. And you can see the tinsel is all spread out here. Look at that. All right. There we go. Nice big charge built up. Now, I'm going to take the ultraviolet wand. I'm going to switch it on. It's got a mercury switch, so I can't tip it and blind myself. Okay. UVC will dry your eyes out and make your skin feel weird, but it's not lethal. And look at that. Drains the charge right off. I'll do it again. Okay. So that charge is just sitting there, trying to get away from itself, and then all this ultraviolet light comes in,
and strips off these extra bonus electrons I'm putting in the conductor. Okay? There we go. And here comes the UV light, and they stop repelling each other. It's draining charge off the tinsel. Okay?
How does that do that?
So that's what I'll get to in a moment. So what people thought was that electromagnetic waves are being generated here in the wand, and that, you know, they'll build up over time, and that eventually the energy of the combined waves will be enough to knock the electrons, which are, you know, not really bound to atoms, and then I added them on from the PVC pipe, okay? It'll be enough to strip those off. And then, you know, it'll happen over maybe a few seconds, okay? This bulb is a 4-watt UVC bulb. I happen to have here, and you can see it in the camera, 9 60-watt incandescent light bulbs. Much brighter. Okay? You know, UV light is more dangerous than visible light. After all, we don't wear sunblock to block ourselves from visible light. It's the UV we're concerned about. But still, the wave theory of light says that even with weaker light, I should be able to take a whole bunch of bulbs, shine them at this tinsel, or at the can, okay, and I should be able to knock electrons off. Let's get a little bit on there. So, let there be light. That's a lot of light. We'll wait. Maybe it just takes time to build up. After all, your friends aren't all on the edge of the pond working in sync. They're all kind of doing their own thing, not paying attention, texting with one hand while they're making waves, okay? So in the 1800s, people waited a really long time for visible light to do something, and they didn't. And nobody knew why. The wave theory said that if I take this many 60-watt light bulbs, which they didn't have at the time, they were probably using candles, but you get the idea. Okay. That should have stripped the charge off this thing. All right, we'll get to what's going on here in a moment. Glass. Do you get a tan when you're sitting in the car on a sunny day? Anyone ever tried that before? You think you do? Glass blocks UV. You can't tan.
All glass?
All glass blocks UV. It doesn't absorb well in the ultraviolet. If I take it away, you're not in any danger from ultraviolet light when you're sitting near windows on a bright day. It's hot. That's uncomfortable. You get the greenhouse effect in a car. Equally unpleasant. Okay? But you're not in any physical danger because UV cannot penetrate glass. It also really can't penetrate water all that well. If you're swimming in the water in the ocean on a sunny day and you forgot your sunscreen, try to stay in the water as much as possible. It'll block most of the UV light that's getting down. Of course, your head has to stay out, so you'll probably get a burn on the back of your neck. But There are many things that ultraviolet light can do, but one of the things it really can't do well is penetrate simple glass. Okay? So you can't get a tan in your car. You have to open the windows and stick your arms out. And then you look like, you know, you get the farmer tan I get in the summer. Okay, you look silly. So what's going on? This is a real puzzle. The wave theory said that, you know, given a few seconds, weak light ought to add up and knock electrons off, but it didn't. It seemed to take high-frequency, short-wavelength light to do the trick. Ultraviolet certainly fits that bill. Okay? So, really, Einstein's explanation was needed. Here's how Einstein explained what was going on. He said that light isn't coming in as waves. It's coming in discrete packets of energy, which he called photons. Okay, little bits of light. And all it takes